wants to be shared from your experience?
I did.
So anything that you felt or questions about teaching?
It's interesting how suggestible I seem to be. You say, talk to yourself.
Yeah. I mean, I would say in many ways we all are, and it's going both ways. The world, our culture, is constantly telling us we're not enough. You need this. You need that. You shouldn't be this. Those that are popular are this. So we're constantly being bombarded with a message that we're not enough, which feeds our whole economy. So how nice that you're susceptible the other way to open your ears big and wide to that. So this sense of holding the bird and very gently opening our hand. Can you feel that? Can you feel that sense of when we're sitting that the point is not always to stay in a very close placement of shamatha? That's what helps us balance and calm the mind and let the mind ease. And at some point, though, that we begin to open that, that up so that there's a sense of slowly we're letting go of the meditator. And it's just this open hand where everything is allowed, but there's just allowing things. And then the bird startles. We startle. We come back into ego. We go back into the thinking mind. We go back into planning or whatever. And then we come back. And I consciously ask us to work a lot with pelvic floor and hips and opening and softening tissue because we want to really... This is a very low... earthy, low energy, low awareness experience. If we start to leave our body or float away a little bit, that's, in many ways, that is a distraction, a disembodiment, it's a dissociation. This is not a dissociation. Meditation is not dissociating. It's one thing I wish Deborah was here because she was talking about last week. And I thought about that so much and I was going, it really felt to me like a dissociation. And I, when she comes back, we can talk more about it. But there's actually this sense of that our awareness of our skin or our boundary might go away. So we don't know if we're sitting this way or where our skin ends, where, you know, and that's natural. But there's a sense of this sort of just open awareness and this open hand. So the awareness of the breath might get less and less and less, but there's just resting in that open awareness. If there's this sense of like lifting off from the body, there usually is some sense of sort of dissociation that's going on. And I don't mean to pick on her, but I'm just saying it was a great example of that. I don't know her experience enough, but it stuck with me enough to go, well, that it isn't our meditation, I'm just going to say it again, is not dissociating. And the edge is, how do we not dissociate while having non-duality, while experiencing non-duality? And that's the work. That's the path. And that only comes, I cannot tell you how, that is just through experience. All of us know when we're dissociating, usually afterwards. And all of us know when we're in some form of duality. So that, again, I'm not going to say very much about because I want you to keep exploring it. Are there any questions about that before I go on? Could be from the body. It could be from it's a sense of sort of either leaving the body or checking out. And we have millions of ways of checking out. But I've had a lot of people who have, over the years, said, yeah, there's a way that I just... there's some sense of like becoming one with the spirit realm. In one sense, that is so. That is how it feels. But there's some sense of if we leave to go there, there's something that's off in that. And usually, if we were to experience, like keep looking at our life, how are we doing that in our post-meditation time? How are we somehow checking out or leaving ourselves in some way? So, any other questions before I come on? So I want to just continue this sort of thread. And has anybody ever heard of Meister Eckhart? He was a spiritual master in the 1600s? I can't remember. Does anybody know? It was a long time ago. Anyway, he said, you want what you are, and you are what you want. So, what you are is not what you think you are. It's actually, it's that is before thought. It's that we're resting in when we're meditating, and the thoughts have sort of eased, or we're letting the thoughts come and go, but we're not being hooked by them, we're not running after them. What is that remains? That's what we are. Okay? The rest of it is an analysis of what we are, what life is, or whatever. So when he says you want what you are, we want that. But we think the way we're going to get that is by getting more. What is that? What's the manifestation of that experience? Freedom.
Peace.
Space, happiness, there's an ease. Okay? But we can't even say happy like from an egoic sense, happy. It's just allowance, which when there's allowance, there's a sense of just ease. In Buddhism, we would call that's more joy, more equanimity. We want that. So we want what we are, but we think that to get to what we are, we just need to get more. Get more stuff, get more this, hold on to that, get rid of this, get rid of that, that's just uncomfortable. And that, what he was saying with that is that when you truly, truly, more than anything else, want what you are, you're free. But there's that dance. Do you understand what I'm saying? You have to know it completely.
It seems if there's want, there's still that separation.
Right.
Seeking
out. Right. You have to know what you are, and the only way to know what you are is to practice. Is to rest in that state.
The want
is that you have to want to rest in that state more than to rest in the thought of that state. Not meaning always resting in meditation, but you have to understand that we don't get that by the egoic mind, by grasping and resisting. That's what I mean. Is that we have to understand. When we fully understand that and want to actually, so we have to give 100% permission for things to exist. That's what I mean. When we give something 100% permission to exist, we actually can rest in that state more. It's the resisting and the grasping at what arises. Is this making sense? Okay, I want to make sure I'm not leaving anybody out here, because this is sort of the key to it. And I'm not going to, again, it's not a how, well, so how do we do that? It's just recognizing. It's really so simple. It's that if we struggle with life, life will always win. Life will always win. We cannot fight against life and win. We cannot fight against what is. We will lose every time. If we actually give permission completely to what is, then there is this sense of actually really wanting what we are. Because what we are is what is. Okay, that is this helping some? Okay. So, when I hold on really tight to something, I'll say it in a different way. Why do I hold on really, really tight to something? Is because if I don't, I lose things. I will, that is part of it, is I will lose things. Things will, there is impermanence. It is the most natural thing in the world for things to fall away. That's why I hold on so tight. Because I don't want things to go away. I don't want things to change. I don't want to lose what I love. I don't want things to, I don't want me to age. I don't want to whatever. I don't want bad things to happen. So much of the Buddha's teaching is that learning, if we just turn our hand over and open up, that more often what will happen is that things don't need to fall, that it doesn't need to be so drastic. There's a sense of opening and we allow what's going to happen. So this was a very important part of my own understanding of this. I had to hold, I had a teacher who made me do this over and over and over again. Hold the thing, hold a pen, and open my hand and let it go. Boom. And get, that is impermanence. That's what's happening. Can I turn my hand over and open my hand in that sense of a giving permission for what is to exist without holding on to it? It is not as scary. It's not as scary because I don't have to, things are not going to fall away in such a painful way. Okay? If I hold on tight and impermanence naturally happens, it hurts. It hurts. But this, there's a sense of that allowing the process to naturally have its natural course. So I would like you to, not everybody has something around them, but I'd like you today when you go home to keep doing this sense of like, what is it to actually give permission to things to take their natural course? So, there's a teaching around this that is often called, it's sometimes called high or divine indifference. High indifference. And often when I've heard that word indifference, that I can think like, well then, does that mean I wouldn't care if I'm indifferent? Or does that mean that maybe I wouldn't have to care if I'm indifferent? But it's actually this sense that it's when there is actually divine indifference, it's not dissociating. It's actually so completely connected and so allowing of what is. I mean, like from the worst that you can imagine. So much allowing what is that from that comes the deepest, the most profound love and compassion and care. But we can't really actually have what we talk about as that depth of compassion and care and love if we don't have divine indifference. So I'm just going to open up. I have more to say, but I want to open up what happens for people. Do you understand what I mean by indifference? Yeah, one taste. One taste. Yep. Boring taste. Aftertaste. but it's one taste. It's that sense of living in the charnel ground where actually, where everything is arising and dying. And I'll just say that I've really noticed since my retreat that if I don't start my practice with actually doing my offering, that is offering to the charnel ground, this sense of letting in all the distressed feelings and all the ooky stuff and all the things I'm trying to resist. If I don't consciously start my practice letting that in, I don't ever really, it's chunky. I don't actually ever open in my practice. There's some way that I'm kind of forcing something. But if I completely, when I start my practice, I open to all of it. So the indifference is that sense of actually allowing things so completely. And from that comes this, that's really where we would start touching on equanimity. So equanimity is not trying to be relaxed, but it's so open that there's just a sense of an equanimous nature that comes. And that my feeling is that we can't really love like in relationship, and this is why it's so hard to love unconditionally in a relationship, is that if we have an agenda and we're not allowing in that is really hard, just letting in all of it, all the experiences that come with it, we actually, it's very conditional love. I don't think it's actually possible to be in a relationship and not have conditional love, but... So this is this sort of love that is, it's not about what the results are. It's this love that is so much bigger than that. It's compassion that is so much bigger, but it's not compassion in the sense that, I feel so much compassion for you as long as you do this. So in Buddhism, there's in the one taste, it's often referred to that we have no preferences. You know, in the Zen patriarchy says, those basically who are enlightened are those who have no preferences. I do not believe at all in this body mind that is conditioned, we don't have preferences. And I heard Adyashanti once say, if the Buddha walked into 31 Flavors ice cream and was asked, what would you like? He would know what he wanted. Either strawberry or chocolate or vanilla, and that it wouldn't be that he was going in there going, none of them, all of them, all the same. We have preferences, but it's watching where we're really attached that our happiness is dependent on the outcome. So it's not that we won't have preferences, it's where we are attached to the outcome of those preferences. So this is where the Buddha, I'm sort of getting a deeper understanding of what the Buddha meant when he talked about the middle way. So the middle way is not like a compromise between the two extremes. It's actually so big and vast that it's opening up. It's not a compromise between good and bad or love and hate. It's like this immensity that embraces all duality. And in that, we find this like place that just is allowing all of the paradox and all of the difference. And there's a place it sort of somewhere in the middle where we're just open to all of it. And this sense of indifference, while also deep, profound care and compassion, and I think that's the place where social action and everything has to come from this place of not caring about outcome, but actually it's just what we naturally do. It's this seemingly opposing experiences of indifference and love happening at the same time. So I'm gonna take a break there, and I want to just see what's coming up for people, what are questions. I'd like to just open it up for discussion, see where you stuck with this, where does it make sense. Thoughts, yeah?
We are what we want. And when he says we are, does that mean this moment as it is with the negative feelings, the uncomfortable tensions in the body, the whole nine yards, mm-hmm. Is that what it means? I guess what I'm saying is that most of the time I'm not what I want. Most of the time
right.
I'm noticing uncomfortable stuff, right. Wishing that it wasn't there, wishing that I was in some expanded state, or some wishing there was more love, or wishing I wasn't bugged by this obsession, negative obsession.
Yeah.
So most of the time, I would have to say that I'm not.
I take it as there's sort of two things happening. One is it's exactly what you're saying, that we most of the time we rest in we're not what we want, but there's some sense that we already have freedom, space, joy. If when we rest and we give permission for that negative stuff, we give permission for all of it, actually what we find, if we allow it enough, is that there is freedom. There's space. You know? But we don't usually take it that far. We keep on the cycle of the addiction, the mental thinking, the grasping, the resisting, or whatever. So it never allows us to actually realize we actually are what we want. Very hard for the human mind to get that, to experience that. And that's why I say, really, to me, the only way on an experiential level, not just to think about it and cognize it, but to actually really feel that, we have to practice. We cannot intellectualize this. Because the experience, when we actually experience it, is completely non-dual. There is no... we just are that. We are freedom. We are space. We are openness. We are connected. You know?
It seems to me that I have to feel all this uncomfortable stuff in the body. I have to like really sit with it. This sense that I feel every little emotional reaction, every little tension, every little sensation.
But
there does seem to be this subtle body reaction thing going on all the time. Most of the time, if I'm just in thinking, I'm ignoring that subtle, I'm ignoring the body, building all this stuff in the mind.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the first thing we do, is that we turn from the outward object that we're either grasping or resisting. And we turn in and realize there's all this experience that's happening. And we just allow the experience and we breathe into it and we let it sequence through. While simultaneously in that, we're opening our hand around the bird so that with time, these feelings and these experiences are there and it's just being sequenced through naturally. You know, so at first, and when I say at first, it might be at first in any sitting that we have, or at first in our, as we're really establishing ourselves in this, it takes effort to take our awareness off of the object out there to what's happening here. That's why I have this so often start on the ground, because it takes deep embodiment to be able to do that practice. And with time, as I say, it may be in our hour, half an hour sitting, or it might be in our lifetime, that sense of slowly opening our hand, that even that in sort of intense, because we don't need to do it as much, because we're just letting things arise and pass without grasping. You know? So I find I go into a deep retreat. By the end of the retreat, there is so much spaciousness around whatever is arising. I don't even need, I'm so embodied that there's not a thought that goes, now I have to come back to the body. That doesn't even happen. Now I come back and I go into my daily life and I have all this, you know, stimulus and I have all this demand and I have to bring a lot more attention to it. I have to keep noticing where is some outside experience that I'm grasping and resisting.
I was listening to a talk by Adi Shanti the other day, and he talked about in this sort of very open meditation of just allowing whatever it is to be, that when the mind sort of says, wait, you know, you should be doing this, he referred to it as sort of a movement of the mind and an attempt to control. And I started to sort of looking at thought, because one of the things I find is that I can be sort of in that place where things are just come, you know, coming and going, and it, you know, everything seems very just totally open to what is.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, you know, I'm thinking about whatever, you know.
Yeah.
And it started to dawn on me that a lot of that thought is just the mind's attempt to control. It's not, in that moment, it's not trying to control meditation. It's just trying to control sort of either sort of a return to the sense of identity or,
yeah,
you know, some long-term.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just sort of interesting. And
I don't know. Yeah,
it just seemed like everything was just an attempt. Any thought was an attempt,
yeah,
to control.
Yeah. I mean, that's because when we go to that sort of just open what is, it's absolute death to the ego. So the ego at that moment, when it starts to figure out what's happening, its job is to keep it all in control. So that's what we have to, just as you are, is to see the ego for what it is. We'll never get rid of it. So in that moment, to see it for what it is and just be going, oh, it's okay. Even that, it's desire to control. But as long, even that, you open up to that, give it permission, it doesn't have any juice. It has, there's no power to it. It's when, as soon as it starts to control, if we try to control it, it's just ego on top of ego on top of ego. So that's why this is so paradoxical, is that the moment we notice that the ego's trying to control, we soften and open around that too. It's like being in quicksand.
Mm-hmm.
You do not struggle.
So would you recommend something other than just sort of seeing the thought? Or, I mean, sort of, say, you know, you're sitting there and all of a sudden you realize, wow, I'm lost in thought.
Right.
And seeing as a thought, and usually in the seeing of the thought,
right,
sort of the bubble bursts.
Right.
Something other, I mean, it almost sounds like you're suggesting sort of an added step of seeing that for the ego and softening versus just thought there, oh, now
right,
gone.
In post-meditation. Notice the ego.
In post-meditation, got it.
In your formal meditation, don't give it any juice.
Just
right in that moment, just
gone.
Again, you open again. Open again. If you're getting lost in the thought and you're getting lost in the thought, tighten your shamatha.
Mm-hmm.
And give yourself the shamatha of something very, very visceral. That's why, like, all the sensation in our hips, and I know that there are some that we might not be able to feel our hips, so we have to find a place in your body where it's very visceral, because that's, again, the bird got scared,
mm-hmm,
bird got freaked out, so we come back and we just let it relax with the shamatha, and then we slowly, and that's just what's going to happen, that the mind at some point, while we're, It gets, I mean, I know you know this because you've practiced so much. It gets, especially when you're on retreat, you know, that arises in that way less and less and less and less. So the work is then, we come back into our daily life and we just know that that's going to happen. No problem. That's the level, that's what, it's like that no problem is what actually allows it to not do that as much. Does that make sense to you? I'm getting this. It's so radical, and it's so simple, but it's really hard to do. It's really hard to do.
The ego does not want to die.
Does not want to die. Does not want to let go. And it's, we have to, that's where I keep using the term that it's our loyal soldier. That's the thing that's trying to actually save us.
Mm-hmm.
It's wanting to save us. It's wanting to keep us okay. It's wanting to make sure that we're not getting less than somebody or too much over somebody, or where are we in relationship to everybody else? And it's a very important aspect of ourselves. Like, if we didn't have that when we were developing, we would be whacked. We'd be in an insane asylum. We have to have a healthy ego, you know? And then the rest of our life is trying to let the ego take a break. Oh, with this human being. I swear, sometimes, lately I've been really feeling this feeling of like, God, what a trip to be a human being. Like, we have infinite potential in our minds of how we work with it. And we want, there's that part of us, the ego, that's going, do the same thing, do the same thing, do the same thing, because then you feel more comfortable. Do the same behavior pattern over and over and over again. Just keep doing the same thing. And it's like, it's just trying so hard to do this familiar kind of thing, even though it causes so much pain. And what happens when we actually, give that space so that that doesn't have to be happening so much. It really is, it is infinite potential. And it makes me, lately I've been starting to, on some level, understand how like some of the masters that I have met, like the Tibetan masters who had, I mean, their ability to foresee the future and experience the past all at one, like, so they're totally psychic in their ability. They're not called psychics because they're just seeing it. There's nothing in the way. And starting to be able to, you know, there's all the stories of people walking through walls and doing these, and traveling. There's a word for it. These spiritual masters who could travel across Tibet at these lightning fast speeds. No one could know how they ended up here when they just left, you know, across the country a few hours ago. It's like I've always taken it as story, but there's a part of me that just lately has started to go, wow, if we really truly did not stop ourselves in some way by the mind, what is possible? You know, really, like, what could the human being or body or psyche do if there were no restrictions? If we never put a restriction in some way? I don't know. I think it's fascinating.
You just reminded me of a great quote that I just read. The author was talking about somebody, and he said, whereas most people would spend all their time trying to be Bill, he spent, or all their energy trying to be Bill, he spent it being Bill.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
It was some, I'm paraphrasing, but it was something to the effect of, whereas most people would spend all their energy and effort trying to be Bill, he spent it being Bill.
Yeah. Right. Which freed up completely all of his energy. He just was Bill. This is why we use this example of a tree. A tree is just being a tree. Their energy is completely freed up for being a tree. That's why when we open our hand to what is, this is the natural state of a human being, to go through this, to have the ego, to do this dance, to have the struggles, to have pain, to have insecurity, to have loss. This is natural. Don't fight it. Profound, isn't it? It's just shocking.
And it's so subtle how I fight it.
Oh.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That's what I'm wondering, you know, when you talk about the Charnogram, what a great way to open our practice, mm-hmm. because what about the hardest of the hardest?
Yeah.
That's where I see how subtle it is, and I'm yeah. so appreciating the way that I don't see it for days sometimes.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
I think I'm feeling it.
Right.
Really gone.
Right. Right. So I would suggest for everybody, you know, I've said this a million times, I give my two little almonds. I start my practice every day, and I go out and I offer it, two to the hungry ghost, and then two to all the difficult things. And then I sit with that. So I've offered that to say everybody is invited in here. So I don't close down to those fringe aspects of my mind that where I'm like going, don't let that in.
That's exactly it.
You know, don't let that in. And it's all the fringe aspects of, I mean, this is like, I'm so hesitant to even bring this in because people don't like it, but I'm saying like child abuse and rape and war. I mean, it's like we have to make room. That's why I say, when we really let that in, then we really touch in on compassion. It's not idiot compassion. It's like compassion that is so, it is like it's hard to even talk about. Can you feel it, that sense of sort of love and compassion? When we're that willing to let everything in, that's, to me, that's when I really, I get rocked, because I sometimes feel that sense that, and we have to do this, but often our love and compassion is from such this conditioned place. It's so conditioned. So it's a very kind of light kind of form. And what I'm saying is when we really can open to that, then we connect to that place that there is no separation between us and anything. And that's from that place, there's the natural action that comes. That's when we talk about right action. That's where it stems from.
And everything is included. So mm-hmm. the offering feels so starting with that.
You're starting with that. Yeah. And what I'm saying, I'm going to sit right down in the middle of this. That's why the Tibetan practitioners would go and practice in the charnel ground. Viscerally, in the middle of the night, with like the dead bodies and the, you know, it's like to sit right in the middle of it and open that much to allowing our fear in. Like let that, our fear that we're so afraid of all the fringe things, this, even if I was to die right now, can I let that in too? That level of like openness. You know, and that's so brave. That's so brave.
I had such a wild image come up last night. My roommate was doing some EFT, that emotional freedom technique, the tapping. Mm-hmm. I had this image come through of an, I was in jail, not me, I was in jail, and I had a jailer next to me outside my little prison. And of course, the jailer's me, but it was like this sadistic, angry, like every part of me that I put aside. It was so incredible to have that knocking finally. That part that's been so, because it's trying to keep me safe. The jailer's trying to keep me safe.
Exactly.
Why are you being so mean to me?
Yeah, oh God, aren't we crazy? All the different parts of ourselves doing this. Yeah.
Wow. So two almonds, is that what you
said? That's what I just give, yeah. I mean, that's just what I do. Where you give a little, I mean, there is something about actually having a physical act instead of thinking it. The physical act really brings it home. You know, and I also think that it's the actual act. I think it is so important that every day, I don't care what the weather is, you step outside. Because there's something about stepping outside and relating to that is bigger than us. For three breaths, just to have that sense that goes, oh, right. It's not just me, you know, but right.
Like the full moon last night.
Oh, my God. Was that just not... God.
Sorry, I was thinking on the non-separation. It's really beautiful to me. Thich Nhat Hanh's comment about my two names.
Yes.
I can't even bring it out loud without crying, but it's
yes.
Like
yeah. Would you bring it next time?
Sure.
And would you read it next time? Can you come next time? Okay, because I have it. If you don't want to, but I would love to have, and I'll remind you, because I'd love to have somebody else read it. It's a beautiful, beautiful poem of how all those are the parts of us. You know, he talks a lot about being on the boat from those that were escaping in Vietnam in the little tiny boats, and his story of you know, the people on the boat, and there would be one person who wanted to, like, rape the woman on the boat or whatever, and when he realized that he was actually the raper and the woman and all the people who were afraid, and he was everything. And I heard him actually once talk about his perspective of the being on the boat, and if one person's energy changed into this sort of allowing bigger, letting in all the aspects of ourselves, the whole boat settled, like the energy on the boat settled. But as long as there was one that was like enemy, that's when it became completely out of control. So it's like that one, that sense of like, and that's why we ended today with that in our meditation, that sense of that really offering that sense of ease, let it permeate out of us, because that's what people feel. And when people feel that they have the ability to be completely, totally who they are, it's the greatest gift we can give to people. I mean, you know what it's like to be in the presence of that when someone completely accepts you. Oh, it's like, you know, it's like warm, it's a warm bath. Anything else?
But I love that image of the bird that startles again, because it's so true in life. We think, I'm trying to be open all the time, but it's just natural.
Yeah.
So that was beautiful.
Yeah. And that just that gentle feeling of just very slowly opening up. That's what we have to do to ourselves all the time, is we can't push ourselves. We can't force anything. It's such a gentle action around ourselves. Is that enough? So let's dedicate the that we dedicate this gentleness, this deep acceptance of what is, this non-struggle, this deep, real love. We dedicate all of this to the benefit of all beings who we're so intimately and so inseparably connected to. Have a wonderful, wonderful week, everyone. Oh, wait a minute.